My name is Greg. I'm coming to you from the CFA. And so thanks to Ash and James for having me here live. So nobody was talking about strong lensing in small-scale structure. It's a field that seems to sort of fallen off the radar a bit. So I figured I would say a little bit of something about that. So this talk is going to be kind of an overview of sort of what we know and why we think we know it from strong lensing. So apologies to any experts in the audience for whom a lot of this will be reviewed. So basically, here's the situation. You have a quasar that is being lensed by some foreground object, background quasar, lensed by a foreground object, and it's split into multiple images. And so the hope is that you can say something about the potential of the lens based on properties of the images. That's basically what we're working with. Okay. So the name of the game here is length scales. So as you probably know, in lensing, there is a relationship between mass and length. And that is obviously the Einstein radius, which is proportional to the square root of the mass. So plugging in some numbers, for a 10 to the 12 solar mass object at redshift half or something like that, the Einstein radius is about 10 to the 0 arc seconds, which is about the image splitting for a typical lens system. And as you go down factor of 6 in mass, you go down factor of 6 orders of magnitude in mass, you go down 3 orders of magnitude in Einstein radius, get down to a milliarc second for sort of substructure type scales, and another 6 orders of mass down to stellar type scales, you get down to a microarc second. So all of these length scales, galaxies, substructure, and stars, are represented in the potential of this lensing galaxy. And so the hope is you can use lensing observables to say something about those different length scales. Okay, so there are a couple lensing observables. First of all, there's the time delays, which I'm not going to talk about, so I'm not listing here. But there is some new work happening on that right now, which we can talk about offline if you're interested. So first is astrometric perturbations, which are proportional to the Einstein radius. So basically, that's just image splittings or perturbing of the position of a given image. And there are magnification perturbations. So there is no such constraint on, in most cases, magnification perturbations. Like there's no correspondence to the Einstein radius in the same way. So for macro lensing, so lensing by the galaxy itself, the scales are on the order of arc seconds. The Einstein radius is on the order of arc seconds. I'll get back to mill lensing in a second. And micro lensing, you really have to zoom in close here and you get these things, which are clustic networks, which are totally different from the clustics we just heard about. So basically, this is a map in the source plane of the magnification at a given point due to stars in the lens galaxy. Okay? So you have these points of really high magnification and points of lower magnification. And so this is how the field kind of changes as you change your stellar distribution. Okay. So before I go on to mill lensing, just a quick point that will come back later. The astrometric perturbations are proportional to first derivatives, or are related to first derivatives of the potential, whereas the magnifications are second derivatives of the potential. That leads to some consequences. All right, so back to mill lensing, substructure. First, astrometric perturbations, which I won't say much about after this, but they're very small. They're on the order of a milliarc second or a little bit more. So they're very difficult to observe, but Jackie Chen and Neil and James had a paper recently last year on ways to do it statistically and some ideas for the future. Magnification perturbations, on the other hand, can be very large. In fact, for point masses and point sources, you can technically get infinite magnification. But the question, and so the idea is that you have some lens galaxy that's lensing the quasar, and then there's some substructure in the lens that's perturbing the images and affecting the magnifications. But how do you know if an image is perturbed? You don't typically know the source flux, right? So the way that you do it, the way that you identify a problem with your lens model in the first place is the so-called cusp and fold relation. So basically, you compare image fluxes. And so in the case where you have three images near each other, the fluxes of the outer two images should asymptotically approach the flux of the central image. And in cases where you have a fold, the two fluxes should be the same. This couple of seminal papers on this topic. So here are a couple of real systems, 2045 and 0712, where the cusp violation is clearly violated here, and the fold violation is the violation here. So the flux of the outer two does not equal the inner one, and the flux of these two is not close to the same. Okay. So this whole field sort of started, as I'm sure a lot of you know, with Mao and Schneider in 1998, 10 years ago. So they pointed out that, you know, since the smooth lens model fails to predict the fluxes, it does a fine job with positions, but it fails to produce the fluxes. And so they looked at a lens system called 1422, which I'll talk about in a minute, and basically showed that if you add substructure, you can fit the fluxes much more easily. And so therefore, the anomaly in 1422 might be due to substructure perturbations. So they turned a phrase, the lack of consistency of the smooth model, to predict these fluxes in terms of this R ratio called the R cusp. It's the sine sum of the images, so this should go to zero in the case of cusp relation. And so they did some Monte Carlo simulations and threw on some point mass perturbations and some plane wave perturbations. So it's plane waves around the azimuthal angle of the lens, and showed that you had to add about 1% of your surface density in point masses to give you a substantial probability for observing the observed R value, 0.2. And fast forward 4 more years, was the whole thing came to fruition with Neil and Chris Kachanik's paper in 2002, which I'm sure you all know about. Some might say conclusion. So they have seven radio lab quads. We'll talk about the radio in a second. And they do some statistical fit where they add a potential perturbation near the images. And there are some issues with the measurement errors, which are systematics dominated in all these systems. And then they reinterpret the potential perturbations in the language of some substructure model with Monte Carlo simulations, and use a subhalo model to basically set a mass scale B, pseudo Jaffe. And so this is the famous plot where, depending on the errors that you assume for the image fluxes, you get these different values for the fraction of the surface density near the images in substructure. And it turned out to be around 2%, with some large variance due to the fact that there are exactly 7 of them. And the substructure mass scale was a little bit less well constrained, but it's broadly consistent with no lens. So that's basically the statistics of the whole thing. So now the problem is that this FSAT is very poorly constrained. Why is that? I said because there are 7 systems. So why are there 7 systems? Well, that gets into quasars. So what is a quasar? A quasar is, as we all know, a black hole with an accretion disk that's about 1/1000th of a parsec in size. And then there's some larger broad line region that's about 1/10th of a parsec. And then there are radio jets that expand out to 10 parsecs or more, and you get gigantic radio lobes. So if you park that quasar at redshift 2, and you convert those length scales to angular scales, the optical continuum emitting part is about 1/10th of a microarc second. The broad line region is about 10 microarc seconds. And the radio region, it varies a lot, but in general, it's about milliarc second. So in terms of the length scales of the lens, the optical continuum corresponds to star-type scales, broadline region, substructure, and stars, and radio emission substructure. So the point is that you need, the magnifications are really only sensitive to mass or length scales in the lens that are on the same size or larger than the source size. Okay, so that's why you need the radio to do this, because otherwise you have stars which are screwing up your fluxes. If you look in the optical, for example, this is about the size of a stellar Einstein radius or less. And so your stars are screwing up your optical fluxes, and you have no information about your substructure, typically. It also opens up the possibility of using multiple wavelengths to look at different mass scales. I won't talk too much about that, but that's something that Ben Metcalf and others and myself and Chuck looked at in 2006. So the last important length scale fact I will talk about is that flux ratios, this isn't often articulated, but flux ratios really only provide information about the structure of the lens that is on the order of the image separation. Okay, so if you're going to identify problems with flux ratio anomalies with custom fold configuration, for example, you need those tight image configurations. Okay, if you looked at an Einstein cross, your length scales between your images are much, much larger than the length scale of your substructure in your lens. So it leads to degeneracies with the macro model. And this was a bit of a controversy when Neil and Chris first put out their paper. Some folks, Evans and Vitt, claim no, everything's okay, you can fit things with smooth models. And there were some problems with that, and there was a little bit of a back and forth. But the nail in the coffin of the smooth models was Art Condon and Chuck in 2005, who fit a couple of lens systems with multiple expansions of the lens potential, which is the, well, these are isodensity contours here. And so this is for a maximum multipole of 9 and a max multipole of 17. This is that system 2045 again. And so there are a slew of problems when you try to do this with smooth models. You get an unphysically large amount of power in low order multipoles, these big things sticking out here. So these are not isodensity contours that you'd normally associate with galaxies that you see, right? And you need higher order multipoles in order to get reasonable fits. But at that point, it's semantics, right? So this is basically like substructure. And these models vary with wavelength, which also is a little bit unphysical. Okay, so for the next couple of minutes, I'm going to concentrate on this finite source lensing idea, to tell you a little bit about how we placed some limits on the substructure mass scale in several lens systems. All right, so here is the quasar. It's being lensed by some galaxy. So that galaxy has some substructures. The diamonds are basically meant to represent those diamond-like clusters. If it has enough substructures, maybe there's a high enough probability one of them might be in front of one of the images perturbing it. So what we did is we zoom in on this one image, and we have a circular source, finite circular source, being lensed by this little diamond. And it's sitting in some convergence and shear field that is supplied by the lensing galaxy, right? So that shear field is the shear field at this position due to the lens galaxy. And then we need some model for the substructure. We use an isothermal model, which has some ups and downs. But some of the ups are that it allows for a nice semi-analytic analysis of the finite source effect. You don't have to do ray shooting or solve the lens equation in complicated ways. And it gives conservative lower bounds, which I'll talk about a little bit more in a second. Okay, so here's magnification pattern. So this is in the source plane, which is related to the ones I showed before for one single isothermal subclump. For various ratios of the Einstein radius of that subclump to the source size, decreasing source size left, right, top, bottom. So you can see that at small source size or large Einstein radius, the point of highest magnification is here. And as you decrease as you increase your source size, the point of highest magnification is here. So the point is that for any given B over A, there's some maximum. B is the Einstein radius, A is the source size. There's some maximum perturbation that you can get from your substructure, right? So these are a bunch of different positions. So keeping fixed at one position and varying B over A, you get these different curves. And so this is basically the point of using multiple wavelengths to probe substructure. But that's not the point of the talk. That's not the point of what I'm saying here. The point I'm saying here is that there's some maximum magnification. And so this region up here is excluded. Okay. So the idea is if you know what magnification you have, then you can go over here and place some limit, some minimum value on B over A. So this is how you set the limit on the mass scale. We try to fit the observed positions and fluxes of several lens systems. The positions fit, fluxes don't so much because of the flux ratio anomalies. So then we relax the flux constraints on one or more of the images to see if we find a better model. If we do, we know that that image is the one that's perturbed. We go in, we find our minimum B over A, taking some source size and cosmology, place bounds on the minimum map. So here's the example of 1422. When we try to fit all four image fluxes, we get a very bad chi-squared. There are 4 degrees of freedom in this model. When you relax the constraints on one of the images, then your chi-squared goes down, naturally, because the number of constraints is 3, so certain tests show that it's statistically significant. When we try to fit A, B, and C, so these three, we neglect the flux of this guy, still have a bad model, ABD, still bad, ACB, bad, BCB, great. So this has a chi-squared per degree of freedom of class 1. So we know that this image A is the one that's really screwing up your model, okay? So then, that implies that based on the magnification perturbation of image A, So the smooth model predicts some magnification. We observe some other magnification. So based on that, we place a limit on B over A, which returns to a limit on the minimum mass, and it's about 2 times 10 to the 3. And we do this for other systems, and it turns out that some other systems need to perturb multiple images. And the substructure masses, that the minimum substructure masses that you imply from this are all in the range that you would expect, 10 to the 3, 10 to the 5, 10 to the 7, consistent with CDM. So there are some issues here which obviously need to be addressed. For example, the mass profile isothermal sphere, probably not the most realistic for substructure. It has some nice analytics, which you can still exploit in elliptical potentials, but you probably want to do something with an NFW. Though I will say that these mass bounds are a little bit conservative, right? Because isothermal profiles are cuspier than NFW profiles and give you stronger lensing, right? So you have more of a flux perturbation for a given sort of mass, right? So if you have an NFW profile, these masses are going to go up to give you the appropriate perturbations. There's also this issue of source geometry, right? So here's a picture of, which one is this? 0957, Debbie Harrisma, this year. So this is definitely not a circle. The axis ratio is not 1. So the source geometry could also be important. All right. So in the last couple of minutes, I will tell you that the future is here. So last year, there was this great paper by McKean and Chris Fastnacht and others with adaptive optics images at 2.2 microns showing this little guy right here in the lens galaxy of B2045 again. Okay? So there is your substructure, and this is your mass model that they came up with. So these are the critical curves and caustics for those who care about that kind of thing. And these are the parameters of the mass model, which I'll say more about in a second. So this is really cool. All right, so we're seeing some substructure, and there are some indications of visual substructure in other systems. Now, you might be a little disconcerted that you can fit this system with exactly one satellite. After all, if you're using flux ratios to probe the mass function of substructure, and you can fit 2045, which is the most anomalous system, with exactly one satellite, then are you really probing the mass function at all? The answer is yes, of course, because statistically the chance of having a big guy right there is low. So, but and furthermore, there may be some issues with this model. So Q is the axis ratio of these two guys, and galaxy, this little subclump here, needs an axis ratio of about a tenth, so it's highly elongated. And it needs a mass of about a hundredth of the main galaxy. And there, the external shear, so this is, all these models are fit with external shears meant to mimic some lensing environment, right? And the external shear that you need to fit this out and the ellipticity of the main lens galaxy are exactly perpendicular, 22 to 110. And we were finding this also when we were modeling the system and placing the bounds on the substructure mass. So the shear and the ellipticity are perpendicularly aligned, and probably this is mimicking some other substructure that is in this lens galaxy. So, but I will point out that flux ratios probe the optical depth, right? So they say something about the size of sort of the Einstein radius of your perturbing subclumps on the sky, and that's basically the first moment of the mass function. Okay, so you can screw with your mass function quite a lot, and as long as you put this mass in the right position and give it the right amplitude, you can do a pretty good job of fitting these things. Of course, then you have some priors about what you think the mass function looks like, and so you can make more of a statistical statement. So, having just said the future's here, I will also say the future is coming. So the problem, the limitation of Neil's paper with Chris was that there are 7 systems, and so this gave really poor statistics, right? So this is the main limitation of the flux ratio substructure analysis as it stands at the moment. And there will be some happenings in the very near future that will solve this problem, or at least make a dent in it. So Pan-STARRS is a large collaboration telescope. A lot of you, I'm sure, know about it. 30,000 square degrees, goes down to 24th magnitude. Well, Pan-STARRS 4, looking at the sky and adding up many times to the 24th magnitude. Pan-STARRS 1, single snapshot, something like 22 to 22.5, right? So this implies that in the Pan-STARRS data set, there will be about 5,000 new lenses. But we don't care about optical. We want the radio, right? Because the optical is being affected by microlensing and stars. We want the radio, so you can really look at larger scale structures in your lens. So there's going to be about 500 new radio lenses that are there. So the issue is finding them, right? So here's what we plan to do. So this is a picture from Sloan of 1422. And I haven't done the image subtraction. But what you need to do is you need to take an optical image, image subtract at a different time. So Chris Kachanek had a paper on this a couple years ago, maybe last year. So you can use the fact that the optical region of the quasar is variable on day time scales, right? So you do the image subtraction, and your four images will have different fluxes at different times. So your residual when you do image subtraction will be extended. It won't be a point source, right? Which you would get for an AGN, for example. So if you do the image subtraction and you look for an extended residual, basically the PSF of these telescopes is all about one arc second, which is basically the image separation. So it gets a little confusing. You'll see a blob. You know where your lens quasars are once you do the image subtraction for extended residuals. So then you go back to some radio survey at low resolution and you look for radio sources. You cross-correlate your residual catalog with your radio catalog and you say, okay, there's a multiply imaged quasar there, there's a radio source there, and then you do something like you go to the VLA and say point at that for a minute in A configuration and get out a map like this. So I will end there and just say keep on the lookout. Next couple years there should be a much larger sample of radio lenses coming. That's it.